session number 17561, reel 3.
Colonel Jarvis, reel 3. You were just telling me about the effects on you of your war experience after the war.
I think I was rather relieved, but at the same time as this terrible anticlimax. As a regular soldier, what do you do now? And that was answered by a marvellous piece of luck, getting a place at Cambridge. The War Office offered to reopen the Cambridge course system for sappers if we could find our own place. They threatened us with 2 years' leave without pay to start with, but they soon dropped that. I walked around Cambridge. I tried to get into 3 colleges with a letter from my headmaster, but they would certainly take me in the year after, 1947. And I'd given up. I walked down Regent Street and came across this opening to a college. Said to the porter, "What is the name of this college?" He said, "Downing." I said, "Is the tutor who deals with mechanical sciences in?" He said he thought he was. And half an hour later, I was accepted. That changed the whole thing. I was engaged then. Changed the whole thing. Gave something to work for after this great reaction to the war.
That was in 46.
46, yes. Absolutely marvellous piece of luck, that. So after all this 6 year delay, I had to go into the lecture rooms and didn't understand what the chaps were talking about to start with. And they all came back. I worked very hard, 10 o'clock every night. Got married. My wife had her first baby. And I got a first. On the fast course. And the extraordinary thing was that people of our age, I think, were better organised than the ones from school. Can you believe that? I think you were. We were in charge of ourselves and knew exactly what we got to do. You must get this drawing right. You must get that one right. People with war experience on the fast course, on the whole, did better than the schoolboys, boys from school.
You had to do 2 years, did you?
And do the fast, what's called the fast course, because the teaching at Woolwich was deemed to be the first year, really. Plus a thing called long vac term. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
They had one of those put in for 6 weeks, do a bit of revision and drawing and trying to catch up on things. That was fine. So I'm very grateful to the army.
Did it affect you with nightmares and so on?
No.
The war?
No. No nightmares. I think about it a lot. What I haven't mentioned enough is the extraordinary quality and morale of the troops, how wonderfully they behaved in this field squadron. They were territorials, double up the TA, they signed on. They were then called up, embodied. They went abroad for 4 years. Half of them didn't come back. Most of the time, they had 2 blankets and a ground sheet. And the rations, the standard sort of rations, bully beef and biscuits and things in lunchtime and a stew in the evening, if you were lucky. And then they put up with it, a tremendous comradeship. They're the people who matter. They were absolutely wonderful. And why, how they put up with it, I don't know. Nowadays you have people short terms of service, active service, and counselling and all sorts of things. But how those men went through that and did their stuff, I don't know. We did our best for them, but they were pretty good.
I think you were involved in the 56 Suez operation. Can you tell me in what capacity that was, please?
In 1956, I was commanding the 24th Field Squadron in Osnabrück, part of the 36th Engineer Regiment. And we were ordered to get ready for Suez. Reinforcements arrived, reservists, reservist officers. We trained, we hung about, we thought the operation was off, And then suddenly the Israelis invaded, and we were told to move to Southampton. Two squadrons only out of the three in this regiment. We arrived after the ceasefire. Chaos everywhere. We got into we were put into a school. We were told to build a bridge, which I did. I was quite pleased to build a bridge, which wasn't really necessary, I think.
Where was it?
Build a bridge across the interior basin in case we had to break out. There was a perfectly good railway bridge there already. And eventually we realised the whole thing was over, and we re-embarked and came home for Christmas. Again, the men were very, very good, these reservists. They put up with it, no trouble at all. Men, most of the squadron were on leave when the Israelis invaded. So we sent telegrams off all through the night saying report to Southampton, like 220 men. 70 or 80 of us had to carry all their equipment and things, and the other 140 all turned up except one man on the dot that morning in Southampton. One man caught the next boat out for some unknown reason. That's a good example of morale, that is, I think. Again, they were very, very good, but I don't think the organisation was all that good. I don't think the people at the top didn't quite know what they were doing. The equipment wasn't right for the bridge to start with. Bits were missing, and then people started shouting about improvise. You can't improvise a baited bridge. I managed to get the water supply going. Took an awful lot of doing that. Mainly by protecting the Egyptians and saying you're quite safe with us, because a lot of them had been shot by the French and the waterworks and things on the first landing, and using their brains to get the water going.
What were the main problems with the water supply?
It stopped, just switched off, you see, and all had to be taken out of the Sweetwater Canal. And the Sweetwater Canal had stopped flowing. The only water in Port Said is from this little canal dug from the Nile. There's no water itself there. It's all a wet salt marsh. And by getting the men into the water and cutting the weeds, we managed to get the flow started again. It's a very low gradient. And we put in lots of chlorine and got the pumps going. And eventually there was some water. But the technical direction up there wasn't very good in Suez.
How long were you in Port Said for?
I think about six or 8 weeks. Came home for Christmas when they were with our tails between our legs.
And what was the attitude of the Egyptians towards you?
There was rioting. In some way it was fun. We had to run the first railway to bring up the United Nations troops. I had a captain who was trained in railways. I always wanted to drive a train, so I took my badges of rank off and went as his fireman. It was lovely. This great big Egyptian railway diesel loco was, and we brought them all up, and they gradually took over. But the direction was quite good. We appreciated how important the water supply was. They say, oh, that's all right, just bring in ships, all this big talk, bring in ships and pump it through the pipes in the harbour. You can't pump a lot of water through a narrow pipe. You probably realise that. It's like pumping from the thick end and dispersing outwards. You can't pump that amount of water through a small pipe, friction thing. But fortunately, we got the flow going again from the Sweetwater Canal, which of course is full of bilharzia here. You know, had to be properly sterilised, and otherwise we'd have been in trouble there, I think. But that was a rather sad operation, I thought.
What was this rioting?
There was rioting when the United Nations arrived. Hundreds of thousands I think 100,000 people in the square on the station and things. Not rioting, demonstrations.
What was the object of the demonstration?
I think it used to get us out, I think. But it was, what would have happened had we succeeded? We'd been keeping another 80,000 troops in the canal forever. It wasn't thought out, was it, the whole thing? And the loading arrangements, chaotic. Since then, things have improved, I must say, from what I've heard, all these operations going out to the Gulf and things, and it's not so bad, but I thought it was absolutely very, very badly laid on. We suddenly realised we had all our vehicles in ships in the Thames estuary, all with flat batteries. And nobody, say, come on, you ought to do something about this. So we basically sent round people with charging engines. That would have been fine, wouldn't it? All a lot being landed at Port Cyber, all flat batteries. But I was very, very badly concealed, that thing, that serious thing.
And
again, the men were very, very good. The reservists had no trouble at all. Because what you can do with sappers, the reservists call up, is you train. It's all something. Right, let's do some bridging, which is jolly hard work, and they're all pleased to get back to bed. Some of these other units are hanging around the Army Service Corps and things, but we trained, and I had no trouble at all with those reservists.
What number field squadron was it?
24th Field Squadron.
And you were the commanding officer?
The major commanding. And it's the one with the Maltese cross on its side. It was the great Malta squadron during the siege.
I wonder if you could go through again, step by step, your own personal experience in clearing Inc. route through the Almain minefield things.
My job with six sappers, headed by Corporal Porter, was to find the second minefield, which we knew was 2,000 or 3,000 yards in front of the first one. To find it, keep on the right bearing, to put a blue lamp at the beginning and a blue lamp at the far end, to find out what was in the minefield, much as possible, and to put nails into any of the anti-personnel mines, just in case anybody stepped on them. There was always the risk going through the minefield to start with. Somebody had to go through it to get to the far end before it was cleared. first minefield was found by a vehicle to the front edge. The Germans didn't have to mark their front edge, so nobody knew quite where it started. It was found by a vehicle blowing up, deliberately sandbagged vehicle, an old one, for which there was no shortage of volunteers. Everybody wanted to drive this thing with sandbags around it. That blew up, so we knew we'd found the first minefield all right. And another officer with his party set about marking that out, putting the blue lamps down. And while the two gapping parties were making their gaps, I moved forward with my half dozen chaps through the New Zealanders, all on the right bearing, onto the Metairie Ridge. And the success signals went up, right and left, and then in front, and I thought, this is absolutely fine, this is going like clockwork. Then came to the leading platoon of the New Zealanders, who said, we're digging in, this is our objective. And I said, what about this? Because there was the tripwire showing the front edge of the second minefield in front of them. They said, yes, there it is, but we have to stay here, this is as far as we go, on this slight reverse slope on the ridge. And I just didn't know what to do. What a terrible anticlimax, I think the word I use. Finally got there and couldn't get through the second minefield, because the idea was we should be protected by infantry. You can't do all this business of sweeping and clearing if people are actually firing at you. And just that moment, my OC, Major Peter Moore, turned up. I'm very, very relieved to see him, and he said, I think we can still get this done if we get rid of that one machine gun, which was firing very, very high. Funny how machine guns usually fire higher at night, the Germans anyway. And a word with the platoon commander of the New Zealand leading company, and without any hesitation said, we'll go and fix him for you. And they went through the minefield and rushed this machine gun. And I started to look at the minefield, see what was there. and they carried their platoon commander back. He'd been shot in the guts, and others were wounded. But it was a very, very brave show, sort of. Should things aren't noticed at night, you see. He should have had a high award for that, I think. And then it was comparatively quiet then, apart from all the shelling going on and the smoke and the dust. And I got my blue lamp down. I put the place was full of S-mines, which I could see in the moonlight. All laid with the prongs 2 or 3 inches showing, as far as I could see. Anyway, once a 1-inch nail was put into those, they were comparatively safe. The mines were British mines, being captured by the hundreds of thousands in Matruh and Tobruk and places. And British wire, I think, because the Germans didn't bother to import wire across the Mediterranean. And while the gapping was going on, I think with one sapper, wandered right over the far side bit. I was feeling really, really bold that night, and there was nobody there, not within hundreds of yards anyway, which makes me think all the more what a pity we didn't start a bit earlier. I think the tank would have got right through that night had we gone 1 hour or hour and a half earlier. But the minefield gapping went through beautifully. Up came the four sappers, all drilled and drilled, trained and trained. It's the essence of anything done in battles, to have a battle drill, so you don't worry too much what to do, you just do it. And the tapes were pegged down, the detector parties came along in echelon, pointed out the mines, the expert mine lifters came behind them, lifted them, put them to the side. Then the picket parties came along, they're quite heavy, carrying all the metal pickets, specially made pickets with brackets on them to take the lamps. Lamps were put on, green on the inside, amber on the outside. Wires put on to channel, barbed wire put in to channel the any advancing tanks into the gap, so they wouldn't go to the side of it at all. Of course, there were quite a lot of reserves, which weren't actually needed. We had very large reserves. The idea is they all trained and trained. If one man fell, he was taken back and somebody took his place, whatever he was doing. So each gapping party totaled about 80 all told, and we had to have reinforcements from another squadron, an army engineer squadron, a corps engineer squadron, to make up the numbers. It all went through beautifully, but it was just too late getting light. As the tanks were coming in, it was getting lighter every moment. And they failed. They could not get through. And we dug in, and the rumours went, oh, the Germans too good for us once again, as people began to say. But we then had to go back near the station. We were crowded in there. Of course, in moonlight, we were easy targets for the bombers. And had quite a few casualties there. Then we moved out to support the Highland Division and mix up some of our own troops. It really was a real dog's breakfast, the whole Alamein. The whole thing was a jumble after that initial attack and not got through. It was a slogging match, just keep on going. We were superior. Other people began to have their doubts. A lot of generals began to have their doubts, say we couldn't do it, including the Highland Division. General Freiburg said he would organise the final attack, providing his own troops weren't used, they were worn out. But Montgomery, on the Enigma of intelligence, he alone, maybe his chief of staff, knew the enemy on the point of breaking. They had so few tanks at their wits' end for petrol and everything else, and were trying to withdraw, held back, detained by Hitler's orders to stand there. So he just kept on slogging, and eventually we won. But I don't think it was a very clever battle. Wonderful performance by the troops. But really, looking back, with that superiority, the desert war, the aim should have been to manoeuvre and put the whole Africa Corps bag in the bag.
When those New Zealanders charged through the minefield, were they being blown up by mines?
No, see, the chances actually of walking straight through a minefield, of actually sending one off, aren't all that high compared with what's going on around you. I'm reading how terrible the Russians were, ordered their infantry to advance through minefields. We had to do that. How else can you get through the minefield? Except with flails, and they were a failure. they tried these flail tanks and things. They broke down to start with, and they were absolute sitting targets for any anti-tank gun, just slowly, ponderously going through the minefield. No, that was the least of things to worry about. I think if you just walk through a minefield, we carried a bit of wire in case there were tripwires, of course, because we feel that first, you see, when we were leading through the first time. I'm surprised that somebody didn't say, look, if you want to get the two minefields clear, you will have to start a bit earlier. But everyone was terrified of Montgomery.